Iran says, quote, the U.S. must cease to consider economic terrorism perpetrated by Trump or recent nuclear terrorism as negotiating leverage and remove all sanctions. The U.S. city of Minneapolis declares a state of emergency amid growing anger over another fatal shooting of an African-American man by a white officer. And healthcare workers across Europe have recorded more than a million deaths from the novel coronavirus. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, Iran has slammed the recent sabotage incident at its Natanz facility as nuclear terrorism and a war crime. In a letter addressed to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said the attack on a safeguarded facility risked releasing radioactive material into the environment. He added Israel that threatened to prevent the revival of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal is now boasting about its actions after the U.S. election. Iran's top diplomat urged Washington to seize what he called economic terrorism against Iran as a negotiating leverage. He also reiterated Iran's stance in the nuclear deal, saying the country would stop its remedial measures only after all sanctions are removed. Well, political commentator Mark Weber says the U.S. would risk its international reputation if it gives the green light to Israel for carrying out sabotage attacks similar to the one at Iran's Natanz facility.
But this is dangerous because the Biden administration wants very much for the United States to play as it believes its rightful place in the world as a world leader. And if it allows these incidents to detract from that, if it goes along with Israel in this, it becomes very difficult for the United States to be any kind of leader role in the world because it's not trusted by the world community. And most importantly, the attitude in Europe will continue to be one, or increasingly one, of distrust of the United States as any kind of reliable partner. The United States is obliged under the by the JCPOA agreement, which was ratified as a United Nations Security Council resolution, to abide by all of its provisions. It's not allowed to quibble or negotiate or try to renegotiate the agreement. And Europe knows this. The world knows this. And so the Biden administration attempt to sort of quibble the thing, it only shows the United States a lack of sincerity, a lack of real will to act in accord with international law. And if that's going to be the position of the new Biden administration, that it can't play an effective role as it would like to as a so-called world leader.
Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says Israel and its allies are responsible for the act of sabotage at the country's Natanz nuclear facility. Kazem Gharib Abadi said Israel's role in the attack is absolutely clear. He also called on the IAEA to condemn the act of terrorism and hold a session to discuss the incident. The Iranian envoy criticized the agency for failing to fulfill its responsibilities towards Iran. Gharib Abadi said Iran is installing centrifuges at the Natanz facility, which are more advanced than the previous ones. Elsewhere, Iran's mission to the European Union called on the bloc to strongly condemn the incident as a threat to international peace and security.
Israel has made no secret of its hostility toward Iran since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which led to the ouster of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi monarchy. Israel, which is also a fierce opponent of Iran's peaceful nuclear program, has been behind the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the past years. On Sunday, Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in the central province of Isfahan was hit by a power outage. Israeli media confirmed that the Mossad spy agency carried out a cyber attack on the site. Iran also blamed the Israeli regime for the incident.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. It can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity, which the Israeli regime has been doing that for many years now.
Said Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident will not slow down the country's nuclear program, rather it will speed up its advancement. He said the IR-1 centrifuges damaged in the blackout will be replaced with more advanced ones. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif also accused Israel of sabotaging the Natanz facility and pledged revenge against Tel Aviv for the attack. Zarif suggested that the attack was an attempt to derail the talks held in the Austrian capital with the aim of reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. The European Union also said the incident in Natanz could have been an act of sabotage and warned against any attempts to derail the JCPOA talks, which will resume on Wednesday in Vienna between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal.
And the bottom line for us is that we are saying that we are rejecting any attempts to undermine or to derail the ongoing diplomatic activities to try to resolve all the open questions regarding Iranian nuclear deal. We try to resolve them through diplomatic means currently in Vienna in the ongoing process of talks and negotiations of the parties of the JCPOA and through our contacts with the United States.
Russia also expressed hope that the attack on the Iranian nuclear facility will not undermine the Vienna negotiations. The Sunday attack came as U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was in Israel for talks with Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed to do everything in his power to stop efforts for salvaging the JCPOA. U.S. media say Washington, which is Israel's closest ally, was not involved in the attack on the Natanz facility, but the timing of Austin's trip has raised doubts about the claim. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has stressed that Tehran cannot trust promises made by the new U.S. administration regarding the revival of the JCPOA. Now the attack on the Natanz nuclear facility can deepen the distrust as the incident further questions the sincerity of such promises.
In a meeting with Iraq's National Security Advisor, the head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has stamped the U.S. as the main source of insecurity in the region. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the matter with our guests. Now, the head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says the United States is the main source of insecurity and organized terrorism in the region. Ali Shamkhani made the remark in a meeting with Iraq's National Security Advisor, Qasem al-Araji, in Tehran. Shamkhani noted that accelerating the implementation of the Iraqi parliament's legislation for the expulsion of U.S. troops will improve stability in the Arab country. He said the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis further exposed Washington's support for terrorism. Following the assassination last January, the Iraqi parliament voted for the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the country. And joining us is Faraz Najim, the manager at the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights. And we also have Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist. Eric, what's your stance here regarding Iran's position and its statements regarding the U.S. military presence? Essentially, what is the United States doing with its hundreds of military bases 11,000 kilometers away from its country? And considering the problems that it has domestically, 11,000 kilometers away, military bases that are in support of dictatorships in West Asia.
In Iraq, with the occupation, it looks like they're pulling out, but at the same time, NATO troops are still in Iraq, and they're increasing. So it's almost as if the U.S. is putting more of the burden onto NATO, and this will be a problem for Iraq. It's the NATO troops are no more welcome than the U.S. troops. I think that Iran really is moving so well in terms of its relations with Afghanistan and with Iraq and India. It's not in isolation the way the U.S. wants it to be. So I think the U.S. is getting worried that it really is losing control of the narrative about Iraq. And that's a very good thing, I think, from a peace point of view of those interested in peace in the region.
Right. And for us, you had just last week, recently, these rare so-called strategic talks between the United States and the Iraqi government. They happen every, I think they've happened three or four times since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Should the Iraqi government have shown a stronger position, a stronger negotiating stance in calling for a withdrawal timetable, a timetable for the U.S. troops to withdraw, as is was requested by the Iraqi people, the parliament, and the prime minister himself was tasked with that objective.
In regard to this this case here, I mean, it was a clear violation of United Nations law, international law, when they killed Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi, because Qasem Soleimani was invited, you know, by the Prime Minister of Iraq at that time, Adel Abdel Mehdi. They also breached the agreement that was binding between America and Iraq, that they couldn't strike inside Iraq unless they got approval by the Iraqi government and they told them what the reason was and who they're hitting. And the United Nations also made that clear after their investigation that this was an illegal attack altogether. He also, Trump, the ousted tyrant, also breached his own Congress because he didn't get no consult, he didn't get no approval from them. So, I mean, the U.S. is working in a manner that's very lawless and very arrogant. They don't care about any law at all, as we can see. They also, you know, work to put impose sanctions on the ICC, the only international criminal court that we have in this world, because it was working not in their interest. They pulled out of the Human Rights Commission because they were condemning Israel, you know, just statements, mere statements. There was nothing, there's no sanctions or anything like that. So they just pulled out and pretty much withdrew from all of human rights. So they don't even care about human rights.
Let me just bring Eric, or I'll bring you back in, Faraz. Let me just bring Eric. Eric, Mr. Wolberg, when the United States, even when it says, alleges or claims, because last year it said that it would withdraw its troops and transition its forces towards training the Iraqi security forces. And this year they said the same thing. It was the statement was almost copy and paste that we're going to transition from combat troops to. But why would it not? Even when it claims that it wants to withdraw from Iraq and Syria, it never actually withdraws from countries like Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan.
Well, it did pull out of Vietnam at long last. It took a long, very serious struggle. And it's not, they don't leave willingly, that's for sure. So you have the legal right, if you're an occupied a people, you have the legal right to resist. So, I mean, the Palestinians are doing it, the Iraqis are doing it, as long as U.S. troops are there. I'm sorry, but Iraqis have a right to resist the occupation. And I think a country like the U.S. or Israel, you really have to push very hard and very long and without let up, and then eventually they will pull out. I mean, wars do have an end. That is the definition of war. So I think that nothing happens quickly. We just have to really keep pursuing, and Iran stands for peace in the region, and I think that we've got to just keep making that clear. And eventually that will prevail.
I'm afraid we have run out of time. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Let's thank our guests, Faraz and Najim, and the manager at the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us out of Ottawa, and Eric Wolberg, author and journalist, joining us out of Toronto. Now, the South Korean Prime Minister is in Iran in a historic visit to mend the strained ties with Iran. The two sides have discussed a host of political and economic issues, including the Iranian frozen assets in Seoul. Yusuf Jalali reports.
This is the first time in over four decades that a South Korean Prime Minister visits Iran. Shang Si-kyun arrived in Tehran on Sunday for a three-day visit that aims to boost bilateral ties. During his trip, Shang held talks with high-ranking Iranian officials, including Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf and Ali Larijani, who was an advisor to leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Shang's historic visit is viewed as an icebreaker to forge stronger ties between Seoul and Tehran after years of strained relations. Now to start with, Tehran says Seoul should unlock billions of dollars of Iranian assets frozen in its banks. The figure is roughly $8.5 billion of Iranian revenues made from oil sales to Seoul. The funds are now blocked in two South Korean banks for fears of running afoul of U.S. sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Tehran says South Korea's inaction toward the issue has been the main barrier in the way of further development of bilateral relations.
Unfortunately, relations between Tehran and Seoul have not seen any development in the past 3 years due to South Korea's adherence to U.S. anti-Iran sanctions that lack any international legitimacy.
The South Korean premier said his country is determined to solve the issue and will make its utmost efforts to prepare the ground for Iran's access to its assets.
South Korea will increase its cooperation with the related countries to unfreeze the Iranian financial resources. This is to get both sides out of the current deadlock in bilateral relations.
Before the U.S. intensified its sanctions on Iran, South Korea was one of the country's largest trade partners outside West Asia and its fourth largest oil customer. Following the 2015 nuclear deal, bilateral trade reached $12 billion in 2017. Yet these exports tumbled down after the U.S. reinstated anti-Iran sanctions in 2018, dropping to minus $90 million in the first half of 2020.
South Korea used to be one of the major clients of Iran oil, and Iran was also a permanent market for South Korea technology from car to home appliances, but this active partnership was abruptly halted by United States sanctions, and I think the two sides have made up their mind to resume their friendly ties despite the United States will.
Shunk's visit follows the Islamic Republic's release of a South Korean oil tanker about 3 months after its seizure over alleged oil pollution. The move is interpreted by observers as an act of rapprochement that, if Seoul compensates by releasing the Iranian assets, can open a new chapter in the two countries' political and trade ties. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Turning to other news now, the U.S. city of Minneapolis has declared a state of emergency amid growing anger over another fatal shooting of an African-American man by a white officer. The Minneapolis mayor also declared an 11-hour curfew starting from 7 p.m. The city has been the scene of clashes between Black Lives Matter demonstrators and police. President Joe Biden has urged people to remain peaceful in their protests. Anger is boiling after a video emerged showing Dante Wright being fatally shot by an officer while being arrested for a traffic violation in Brooklyn Center. The police say the gunshot was fired by accident.
As I watched the video and listened to the officer's commands, it is my belief that the officer had the intention to deploy their taser, but instead shot Mr. Wright with a single bullet. This appears to me, from what I viewed and the officer's reaction in distress immediately after, that this was an accidental discharge that resulted in the tragic death of Mr. Wright. I'm also stressing that I do hope for the community.
The police chief added that the officer is placed on administrative leave while investigations into the incident are underway. Several instances of police brutality against African Americans have sent shockwaves across the U.S., sparking protests calling for police reforms. Health officials across Europe have recorded more than a million deaths since the outbreak of the novel coronavirus as the disease continues to wreak havoc on the continent. The death toll in Europe is the highest of any global region, with several countries reporting a surge in infections and deaths. Britain reported the highest number of new cases since April, with more than 3,500 infections. The latest figures pushed the country's total cases to over 4.3 million. And more than 127,000 deaths. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A previously undisclosed document prepared by the Pentagon for internal use reveals dramatic new details about how authorities sought to quell the attack on the Capitol building on Wednesday, 6th of January, and re-establish order, and how such help took agonizing hours in coming. The previously undisclosed internal Pentagon report reveals how officials sought to re-establish order during the 6th of January attack on Congress. The article you're about to hear has been taken from the Associated Press in Washington. The piece is titled, "Clear the Capitol, Pence Plea Amid Riot Retold in Dramatic Pentagon Document." Stay with us for more of the Associated Press article. Previously undisclosed document prepared by the Pentagon for internal use reveals dramatic new details about how authorities sought to quell the attack on the Capitol on 6th of January and re-establish order, and how such help took agonizing hours in coming. The previously undisclosed internal Pentagon report reveals how officials sought to re-establish order during the 6th of January attack on Congress. 2 hours after the Capitol was breached, as supporters of Donald Trump pummeled police and vandalized the building, Vice President Mike Pence tried to assert control. In an urgent phone call to the acting defense secretary, he issued a startling demand. "Clear the Capitol," Mike Pence said. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi were making a similarly desperate appeal, asking the Army to deploy the National Guard. "We need help," Chuck Schumer said, more than an hour after the Senate chamber had been breached. At the Pentagon, officials were discussing reports that state capitals were facing violence in what had the makings of a national insurrection. "We must establish order," said General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in a call with Pentagon leaders. But order would not be restored for several hours. The Pentagon document was obtained by the Associated Press. It adds another layer of understanding about the fear and panic whilst the insurrection played out, lays bare the inaction by former President Donald Trump, and shows how his refusal to call off his supporters contributed to a slowed response by the military and law enforcement. It shows that intelligence missteps, tactical errors and bureaucratic delays were eclipsed by the government's failure to comprehend the scale and intensity of a violent uprising by its own citizens. former President Donald Trump not engaged, it fell to Pentagon officials, a handful of senior White House aides, the leaders of Congress, and Mike Pence, holed up in a secure bunker to attempt to manage the chaos. Along with hours of sworn testimony, the Pentagon document provides a still incomplete picture about how the insurrection advanced with such swift and lethal force, interrupting the congressional certification of Joe Biden as president and delaying the peaceful transfer of power. Five people, including a police officer, died as a result, a direct result of the riot. More than 400 people have been charged. Lawmakers still protected by National Guard troops will hear from the Inspector General of the Capitol Police this week. Any minute that we'd lost, I need to know why, Senator Amy Klobuchar, chair of the Senate Rules Committee, which is investigating the siege, said last month. The Pentagon document provides a timeline that fills in some gaps. Just before noon on Wednesday, 6th of January, Donald Trump told supporters at a rally near the White House they should march to the Capitol. The crowd was at least 10,000 strong. By 1:15 p.m., the procession was well on its way. Some immediately became violent, busting through barriers and beating up police officers who stood in their way. At 1:49 p.m., as violence escalated, the then Capitol Police Chief, Stephen Sund, called Major General William Walker, commander of the Washington, D.C. National Guard, to request assistance. Stephen Sund's voice was crackling with emotion, Walker later told a Senate committee. Walker immediately called Army leaders to inform them of the request. 20 minutes later, around 2:10 p.m., rioters broke through the doors and windows of the Senate. They marched through the halls in search of lawmakers, counting electoral votes. Alarms announced a lockdown. Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund asked for at least 200 National Guard members, and more if they're available, but no help was immediately on the way. The Pentagon documents detail nearly 2 hours of confusion and chaos as officials attempted to work out a response. By 4:08 p.m., as rioters roamed the Capitol yelling for Mike Pence to be hanged, the Vice President called Christopher Miller, the acting Defense Secretary, to demand answers. The call lasted only a minute. Mike Pence asked for a deadline for securing the building. Donald Trump broke his silence at 4:17 p.m., tweeting that his own supporters should go home and go in peace. By about 4:30 p.m., the military plan was finalized. Reports of state capitals breached turned out to be bogus. At about 4:40 p.m., Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer were again on the phone with General Milley and Pentagon leaders. The congressional leadership accused the national security apparatus of knowing that protesters planned to conduct an assault on the Capitol, the Pentagon timeline says. The call lasted 30 minutes, including a discussion of intelligence failures. It will be another hour before the first 155 National Guard members arrived. Dressed in riot gear, they started moving out the rioters. There were few, if any, arrests. At 8 p.m. on Wednesday, 6th of January, the Capitol was declared secure.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In these series of shows, we are trying to ask and answer some doubts and misconceptions which is usually being asked by different questioners in theological and Islamic issues. So, for this series of shows, we have been inviting scholars and researchers from Qom Seminary Schools. Like always, we have Sheikh Murtada Karimi in the studio with us, and we shall start our questions with him. But before starting the discussion, I'd like to welcome Sheikh and say salam to Sheikh Murtada.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikhuna. The question that we need to ask today is about the evolution theory. It has been asked that the genetic similarity that can be seen between human beings and chimpanzees can bring this idea to us that there is a relationship between these roots between the human beings and the animals like chimpanzees, that we, as we said, that the genetic studies shows that they are very similar to each other. Can it bring this idea of evolution theory at the board to say that, bring the idea of evolution theory up to say that it can be also one reliable theory that can be looked at or can be trusted? What is an Islamic perspective towards this issue? Is there any relationship between human beings and animals, and what does Islam say with regard to the evolution theory as well?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this question tries to say that the genetic similarities between human beings and the monkeys, it's a reason to prove the evolution theory. First of all, let's be clear about this theory. Does Islam reject the evolution theory? Not necessarily.
Yeah.
You know that we have the theory of creation, the fact that this generation of the human beings, they are temporal, meaning that it goes back to the creation of Adam alayhi salam, which is like between 10,000 or 15,000 years ago. The followers of evolution theory, they believe that some of them, they claim that the story mentioned in the Bible and the Quran about creation of Adam from a clay is wrong because of the fact that we can prove that human beings have been, developed during the history, and based on evolution theory, first of all, we have the monkeys, and then they are completed in form, and then finally they come to be human beings. Now the point is that there is a middle way. So it's been mentioned by some of the great Muslim scholars that Islam is not against the evolution theory. Islam doesn't prove that, neither reject that. How can we reconcile between the both? The point is that we can imagine that, during 1 million years or less, more or less, monkeys have been developed and they have come to be a sort of human beings, which lived, for example, 100 years ago. But then they have come to end. And 10,000 years ago or 15 years ago, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala creates a new generation of human beings, which is not necessarily like that one, that human being, which was developed out of monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
So Adam alayhi salam is created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, although we might have some things similar to human beings before that out of evolution. So there is no contradiction between this evolution theory and the theory of creation.
Yeah.
And of course, when we refer to the books of tafsir and interpretation of the Quran, you see that some scholars, they have tried to bring some verses to reject the evolution theory. But at the same time, some have brought some verses of the Quran to prove the evolution theory. So my point is that the evolution theory is not against Islamic teachings and Islamic doctrines. We can believe in that and at the same time believe in the theory of creation of Adam alayhi salam. And interestingly, it's been mentioned that at least it is claimed that Darwin, who brought about this theory, he himself believed in God. Because, I mean, typically many people who try to believe in this idea, they also try to reject the concept of God and believe in a creator. But the one who brought this theory, he himself believed in God.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to take that into consideration. There is, if we believe in evolution theory, it doesn't mean that necessarily we need to reject the theory of creation as mentioned in the Quran. No, we can have both. The second point is that it is true that there is a kind of genetic similarities between human beings and some types of monkeys, but some scholars also have shown that there is a kind of genetic similarities between human being and the horse and the donkeys. So can we claim that it's been also
from the same generation, evolution theory?
So mere genetic similarity does not prove the fact that human beings is the developed form of the donkeys, of the monkeys. Then there is a question that those people who are against the evolution theory, they pose that, okay, if you believe in evolution theory, why has it stopped for many years, for many centuries? If monkeys were supposed to be developed gradually, why no monkey is turning into human being anymore during the last many centuries? And why there is no great difference in human beings, why human beings are not, developed anymore? The other main answer is the fact that although there are some similarities, genetic similarities between human beings and some types of monkeys, there are also great differences. For example, even those, the followers of evolution theory, they have agreed that, the average height of human beings is more than that of the monkeys for 38%. When it comes to their weight, they are weightier than monkeys for 80%. And their longevity is 50% more than that of the monkeys. The brain of human beings is four times as the brain of the monkeys. There are great differences when it comes to, stomach and the digestive system. And it's been mentioned that, for example, only human being can touch the tips of their four fingers with the tip of another finger. No monkey and no other animal can do that. When it comes to the face, in the face of human beings, we have 40 muscles that can show different states like smile, sadness, happiness, anger, and so on and so forth. But for the monkeys, it is only 12 muscles, and they cannot show all these states. It is only human beings who can think, ponder, develop the science, bring about new invention, even produce poetries and compose poetries, and so on and so forth. So with all these differences, we cannot say that only because of some similarities between genetic similarities, we can prove the evolution theory. Again, I repeat that we are not going to reject that. The point is that although there are similarities, but there are many, many, many great differences as well. It is only human being who can, for example, cook new food for himself. Mm-hmm. And it's been also proved that we know that human beings can use different means to produce new other means, but when it comes to monkeys, it's been proved scientifically that only they can make differences in three things. And when it comes to training, they can only learn three or four phrases to use them for communication and interaction. And at the same time, they can only use three concepts or, can do three activities at the same time. But we know that for the human beings, it's much greater than this. So again, I repeat, Islam is not against the evolution theory. Of course, some Muslim scholars, they believe that according to some verses of the Noble Book of Quran, the evolution theory is rejected. But mm-hmm. I believe that at least Islam, can agree with that and can disagree with that. There is no, it's not a necessity for Islam to reject the evolution theory. Mm-hmm. The evolution theory can be accepted, and at the same time, we can accept reject. The theory of creation. When it comes to genetic similarities, as I mentioned, there is genetic similarities between human beings and some other animals. And second of all, although there are some similarities between human beings and some types of monkeys, but the point is that at the same time, there are many, many great differences that we cannot ignore.
Mm-hmm. So it means that even genetic similarities does not bring a strong proof or to prove the argument that
that's true.
There is a sort of, let's say, convergence between the theory of creation and the evolution theory. But at the same time, there is also no drastic and actually no clear-cut difference between the creation and evolution theory. If
that's
I'm
true.
Okay. Many thanks, Sheikh, for your explanations, and you respected listeners for staying tuned and listening to the to this show. And we have been talking about the evolution theory and its acceptability by Islam or Islamic scholars, and it was answered that actually evolution theory is not rejected totally by Islam, and some Islamic scholars even accepted that, and on the other hand, some Islamic researchers and even interpreters of the Holy Quran rejected that, and they said that they cannot find a strong argument in that. And but what was answered here, we understood that there is no contradiction, there is no clear-cut contradiction between the creation theory, which is proposed by Islam, and also the evolution theory. And on the other hand, the genetic similarity that is looked at in evolution theory cannot strengthen the argument to say that there is a total similarity between human beings and animals, specifically monkeys or chimpanzees, because we can also find some similarity between some genetic similarity between human beings and also donkeys and horses and other kinds of animals. So it does not necessarily bring any strong argument, any strong proof to strengthen the argument. Many thanks, brothers and sisters, for staying tuned and listening to IRB English Radio Q&A on Q&A Islamic Bliss from IRB English Radio.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين
حسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لن نخشى محن.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The former British ambassador to Bahrain, Peter Ford, said, "I can say from personal experience that the Persian Gulf rulers are very generous with the money of their citizens and are very ready to shower visiting British royals with very expensive gifts. It was one reason why the British royals were always super happy to visit Persian Gulf monarchies. They were guaranteed to receive expensive gifts like diamonds, racehorses, holidays on private islands, cars, and the British royals have a constant problem with money." We now present you an article written by staff writers of Iran's English language TV channel Press TV. The piece is titled, "British Royals Lend Legitimacy to Tyrannical Arab Monarchies." Please stay with us for more of the Press TV article. A decade since widespread pro-democracy protests rocked the Arab world, many of the autocrats in these countries still remain in power. The promises of reform turned out to be big lies, while torture and imprisonment of political dissidents and journalists persist to this day. While these kings, sheikhs, and emirs are ruling their people with a rod of iron, the British royal family seems to be more than willing to visit the Persian Gulf tyrannies, presumably giving them legitimacy and a pat on the back. A new research by Declassified UK has thrown into sharp relief the unconditional support the Persian Gulf autocrats have enjoyed over the past decade by the House of Windsor. According to the Daily Maverick, Britain's royal family has met members of autocratic West Asian monarchies nearly once a fortnight since the crackdown, adding up to over 200 meetings over the last decade. The former British ambassador to Bahrain, Peter Ford, wrote, "The main significance of these royal contacts is about legitimacy, because the British institution of the monarchy represents a purported form of international legitimacy. British royalty is supposedly respected. It has an enormously long history, and to be seen to be with and have the approval of the British monarchy is seen by outsiders as a form of legitimacy, of approval for the way you're running your own country. Prince Charles, expected to be the next British monarch, has had 95 encounters with the Arab monarchies since 2011. Almost half of Prince Charles's meetings with Arab royalty. Prince Charles is followed by Prince Andrew with 70 encounters. Four of Andrew's meetings were with Sheikh Abdullah, the King of Bahrain's second son. Meanwhile, Bahraini royals with 44 meetings, followed by the Saudi royals with 40 meetings, have had the most visits with the British royals. The visits have usually coincided with grave violations of human rights in these monarchies. For instance, Prince Andrew paid a visit to the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi in 2017. The same day, five Emirati activists were sent to prison for an alleged insulting the United Arab Emirates leadership. Or Prince Nasser bin Hamad Al Khalifa of Bahrain, who is accused of torturing pro-democracy activists and participating in the bloody war on Yemen, has met the British royal family up to seven times since 2011. Peter Ford says, "When we were organizing visits, there were always worried that some scandal would emerge on the eve of a visit. Some scandal, usually involving repression and suppression of human rights. This is always particularly the case with Bahrain, where human rights are and were flouted on a daily basis. And it was always touch and go until the last minute whether a royal visit would go ahead, because there might be some protest, some demonstration, something, some court case, something happening which would make it embarrassing for a British royal to come out on that particular timing. Although these meetings are supposedly apolitical, they're all organized by a royal visits committee in the Cabinet Office, which consists of trade officials, senior palace staff, and prime ministerial aides. The overarching aim is to strike hefty arms sales or energy deals with the oil-rich kingdoms in the Persian Gulf." The former British ambassador to Bahrain, Peter Ford, says, "When I was organizing visits by British royals, it was usually with an eye to cementing some arms deal. It's no accident that royals are generally part of the military institution, with the ruler, the monarch, usually the commander-in-chief. So there's a very close connection between royals and guns and anti-democracy, and the suppression of democracy with guns. So the royals were very often sent to the Persian Gulf to help British arms firms lobby for business. To serve this purpose, the House of Windsor sometimes uses its personal friendships with these monarchs to improve UK relations through shared interests such as horse riding. King Hamad of Bahrain is a regular guest at the annual Royal Windsor Horse Show, while the ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, frequently appears with Queen Elizabeth at horse competitions. In 2019, Queen Elizabeth gave a trophy to the Sheikh's racing team, despite rumors that he had abducted two of his adult daughters when they attempted to escape from the United Arab Emirates." The British royals have also met the Emirati counterparts at least 28 times since Islamic awakening. Meanwhile, Queen Elizabeth, for example, has received millions of pounds worth of jewels from the West Asian monarchs, above all the Saudi king. Former British ambassador to Bahrain, Peter Ford, adds, "I can say from personal experience that the Persian Gulf rulers are very generous with the money of their citizens and are very ready to share visiting British royals with very expensive gifts. It was one reason, I suspect, why the British royals were always super happy to visit Persian Gulf monarchies. They were guaranteed to receive expensive gifts like diamonds, racehorses, holidays on private islands, cars, and the British royals have a constant problem with money. Surprisingly, as it may seem, and therefore always extremely happy to receive gifts of this nature from the Persian Gulf royals, who, generally speaking, the more fragile the monarchies, the less representative, the less legitimate it was, the bigger the gift they would get. While the royal family's tours of West Asian monarchies since 2011 have cost the British taxpayer about £1.4 million, the contents of the meetings are mainly shrouded in secrecy. Peter Ford adds, "When we were organising such a visit, never a thought was given to the actual costs, such as you mentioned. There was an assumption that the payoff, in terms of arms contracts or some other financial contracts, would be much bigger than those costs. Those kinds of amounts would be incurred through travel costs." The former British ambassador to Bahrain, Peter Ford, adds, "No one gave a second thought to how costly the business was and how effective it was, because in my personal opinion, those arms deals would have been concluded with or without the royal visit, with or without the royal consent." Yet WikiLeaks published some US embassy cables dating back to the years before 2011 protests, which shows the significance of royal visits as a tool of London's foreign policy. One of these WikiLeaks reports underscores that a 2006 visit to Riyadh by Prince Charles and his wife Camilla played a role in rebuilding Saudi-UK ties after some tensions between the two sides. The meetings are still being held between the UK royal family and the Persian Gulf monarchies, all to the detriment of the nations which long for freedom and democracy.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.